So welcome everyone. For those who weren't able, we had a day of mindfulness yesterday at the Becker's home in Golden Gate. It was a good time. It was nice. There were a number of people from different sanghas and communities around South Florida. It was good to see lots of people. So before we begin tonight, are there any questions that anyone has about practice, meditation practice, Dharma practice? Anything that's not clear or... Yes. I don't think that's a clinical... diagnosis. I don't think you need to worry. Yeah. So the question is about walking meditation. Everybody heard, and yesterday, the day of mindfulness, we do outdoor walking meditation, and what she was saying was that we do two rounds of it, and the first time people were given certain instructions, but the second time one of the instructions given was whatever pace you walked that first time, walk at 50% that rate. And I'm just saying, that felt good to you. Again, I think, Thich Nhat Hanh recommends slowing down. If anybody's ever spent any time with him, we know that he does everything slowly. So it's hard to say whether we are experiencing someone who has consciously slowed down, or he just wants the rest of us to join him in that capacity. I think slowing down a lot is like slow motion. You know, if we're watching a movie or something, to do it in slow motion is to be able to see more clearly what is there. To take a little more time with each frame, we're able to identify what's really occurring. You know, and many times we know when we slow it down, we see things that we miss when it was kind of moving quickly. So in that sense, many of the Buddhist meditation is done very slowly. No, that's not always true. There are some Zen groups that walk quite quickly, but traditionally it is slow. And just for what you said, it allows us to attend to really the phenomena are appearing to us consistently. And we often, usually miss it. And whether that is when we are walking, when we are looking, when we are listening, when we are smelling, and also when we are observing the risings and the passings within our own mind of thought and feeling, the capacity to slow down is able to see clearly that that's all that's happening. And that truly, even though it appears to be, one of the things when you slow it down is you really see that, and if you really slow it down, you see, as opposed to the way it appears, which is like things are just unfolding, actually when you slow it down, you see it's frame by frame by frame by frame by frame by frame. In the same way, it appears to us that our mind is moving nonstop. But the truth is, if you watch it very carefully, you see things are constantly arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And there is space between every thought, feeling, between every arising. Right? And so we think it's all linked, but actually there is nothing linked yet. Right? In the same way, phenomena is constantly appearing to our eyes, to our ears, to our nose, smell, sounds, taste, touch, etc. And it appears that there's something solid there. But it's only upon really slowing it down and looking very clearly that we see that there's nothing solid. There's nothing connecting anything. There's space. In the same way, we may, when we look at a waterfall, the waterfall, there appears to be something called a waterfall. You know, a solid sheet of water is falling. But we know that in truth it's really just drops. Right? All very close together and they're all coming very quickly. And so it appears like there's something called a waterfall. But upon looking carefully, we see, no, it's just single drops. Now again, I mean, that doesn't change the overall experience when one just wants to experience a waterfall. But if one wants to understand what a waterfall is, slowing it down does make a difference. When we want to truly understand what is actually going on in the realm of our own experience, is there anything solid here? Whether if there's anything solidity in terms of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, a thing called my mind. I mean, many people think they have a mind. There may be people in this room who think they have a mind. That's a thing. But upon investigation of one's own mind, one cannot find any solid, anything consistent. One finds lots of phenomena that are rising, passing, but that's all it. Many people feel or believe they have a solid self. There's an I, there's a me. Because it feels that way, or it appears that way. Because there seems to be something that identifies all of one's experience with a thing. But again, when you slow it down enough, and you look deep enough, you see there is nothing linking it. So slowing down is good for lots of reasons. But it's also very good just because it's culturally. because we, as Americans, it's all quick. And we're rewarded for being quicker and quicker and faster and faster. You know, the Olympics are on now, so it's a good background. Right? I mean, the object is what? Faster. How fast? Faster than the last guy. Right? I mean it's all about, can I do it faster? And like we you know, and I'm not saying, I'm not putting it down, but I mean, you know, it's like seconds. It's like quarter seconds. I mean, in the realm of anything of significance, we would say that's insignificant. And yet, we say what? Faster this year. Right? How much faster? 1.2 seconds faster. It's just an interesting world we live in. And, you know, information is being processed faster and faster. People are managing information at faster and faster rates. And we don't realize that many of the illnesses that we have is because we are suffering from living in a world where everything is just unfolding so quickly. And our minds are just racing to keep up with it. And then we wonder why we have headaches, why we have sleep disturbances, why we have all these other kinds of ailments. You know, bodies that are all out of whack. Very difficult. Very pressured, very tension producing to manage all this information, stay on top of it. So, you have to slow down. I think it's very good for the health of our body mind. It's good for us to slow down so we can touch. Because when you go very fast, you skim over reality. You sort of zoom through your day. It's all very quick. It's very hard to have kind of meaningful experience. Right? To have quality experiences with anything or anybody if we're not willing to engage. It's very hard to engage with anything when we're zooming by. Hi! As we pass each other, we quickly acknowledge each other. But it's hard to call that a meaningful connection. It's an acknowledgement. If you want a meaningful connection with another human being, unfortunately, we have to do it the old-fashioned way, don't we? Right? And we really have to stop and spend some presence. We have to share our presence with each other. We have to, stop and be real with one another. It takes time. A lot of people don't have time anymore. There's no time for relationships or any of those. So, it's good to slow down. Any other questions about practice?
But on the other hand.
Yeah. Well, or on another hand.
On another hand.
Yeah, there are lots of hands.
there are times when we have to go back.
Yeah.
And it sounds as if going faster kind of conflicts with practice.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for sticking up for going fast. You know, it's sort of like, you remember the day of mindfulness yesterday, somebody talked about, you know, we spent some time talking about, well, the career of the bodhisattva and changing one's life and living a life of meaning and all that. And again, in answer to some questions, you know, I think one of my responses was, you know, if you're a single person, you know, very free, without responsibilities, it's very easy or not that difficult to do a 180 in your life, right? But on the other hand, again, if you, you know, if you have multiple dependents and lots of responsibility and children and significant, you know what I mean, et cetera, et cetera, it is not so easy because, for obvious reasons. And so that's just kind of dealing with reality. I mean, we can say, ideally, you know, I would love to live congruent with my values, right? And live a life that's totally coming from my the core of my being, and that everything I do, every relationship I have, the work I do, you know, is 100% expression of that. But again, you know, that the predisposition of that is a pre, or the presupposition is I have the freedom to do all that, and many of us don't, you know, for lots of reasons. And so every teaching has to be again, you know, the a teaching is just a teaching. It presents a certain truth. But that truth has to be appropriate for the person receiving the truth, quote unquote, and it has to be applied skillfully. You know, those are always within Buddhism. Those are the two, you know, appropriateness and skillfulness has to be done. So we can say, ideally, right, you know, to have the capacity not to be a you know, quadriphonic multitasker. You know, able to, you know, be on the computer, answering emails, writing briefs, talking to somebody on your jawbone, you know what I mean, and a few other, you know, paying attention to your BlackBerry, and, right? It would be nice to put that all there. So again, most of us live in the world that somewhere on the continuum would be, I'd love to put it all down, and on this end of the continuum, I'm just overwhelmed with all of it, right? And I think for all of us, we need to find that place. And that place has a lot to do with our own capacity to take somewhat control of our lives, combined with the reality. Now, having said that, so let's say one finds oneself, you know, one's really looked deeply at it and says, I'm up on the continuum, you know, I really can't see myself budging out of here. Just the nature of my work, my life, I mean, I really can't do it. All right. So that's, you know, that's a point that each of us has to come to. But again, I would just because we are so driven by habit force and we are so used to doing it the way we've always done it, I only say it's often good to kind of step back because there's often more play in our lives than we're aware of, and that's an important consideration. You know, it's just especially when we're moving very fast, we often don't see that, you know, that there are other ways of doing it because we're so caught up. So oftentimes that capacity to step back, right, and to come into a place where there's some calmness, some clarity, and some objectivity. We can step and kind of look at our life. You know, we may find there's more play and opportunity to make it a little different than it is.
things may not be as out of control as we think it is. There may be ways of modifying and changing things. You know, either the environment or the way I do things, or how I say yes or no, or, you know, all that stuff. But we don't need to get into time management here. So let's say that all that's true. So then the key thing becomes, and this again, I remember I began in a Zen tradition where actually, because of the combination of Rinzai and Soto, they kind of walked somewhere in the middle. Soto Zen and Japanese Zen walk very slowly, and Rinzai Zen, they kind of zoom around. They walk quite fast. And again, when you go to enough different places like that, you realize there's no truth. Right? I mean, there's no right way of doing things. And certainly one can move quickly and still be mindful. Again, when you walk slowly, it gives you other opportunities, not just in terms of the walking, but just in terms of noticing. I think there is something to be said for slow walking. But coming back to what you said, so the key point always is, even when the external world is moving quickly and things are rising and passing quickly, I don't have to be quick myself. I mean, that's the key thing. Because I think the truth is, and again, I'm not to say that fast-paced, pressured, multitasking life doesn't take a toll. You know, the research is not in on that. Whether just that lifestyle in and of itself is not in and of itself a hardship to people over time. You know, in the same way we know that physically, when people are under certain kind of stressful, difficult conditions over time, the immune system, there are other kinds of things that are affected by it. In the same way the mind may be. Again, if things are arising and passing quickly, the emptier I am, the emptier the vessel is. Right? And these things that are arising and passing are just arising and passing, we could say, in air. There's nothing grasping. There's nothing holding. There's nothing solidifying. But one can move through lots of activity. And be very, it's like the center of the storm, the eye of the storm. The eye of the storm is calm. Right? I mean, just because the car is racing quickly, my mind does not have to be racing quickly. So, you know, the practice does give us a way to be in the world of lots of activity, and yet not be caught up in it. I mean, my sense for many people is the pressure, when people talk about, you know, the pressures of life, the pressures of my job, the stresses, a lot of times what they're talking about isn't just the actual activities that they're involved in. It's the way they're processing it. You know, there's frustration, there's fear, there's overwhelmingness, there's anxiety, there's, you know what I mean? There's resistance. You know what I mean? And so I think a lot of the stuff that fills the mind that causes one to feel stressed or pressured or all these things, overwhelmed, are actually produced from our own incapacity to really be cloud and water. You know, as then we talk about cloud and water. To be like cloud and water. You know, clouds move, change their form just because of causes and conditions. Right? They're always changing, always move. They're solid, they appear solid. Then they become another shape, then they disappear, become rain, then they come back and become something else. The wind moves this way. It's like a cloud. It's always forming and reforming according to causes and conditions. In the same way, water. We know that water has a great capacity to just keep moving. And when it meets with obstacles or things, it goes around, it goes under, it goes over, but it always keeps flowing. It doesn't stop. Right? And so, in Zen, the expression to be like clouds and water is really telling us, is giving us guidance or guidance how to be in life. Just to move along with things. Right? I mean, sometimes, you know, the river moves slowly. And sometimes the river moves very swiftly. And sometimes lots of, you know, rocks and rapids, and it gets really kind of, right? But it keeps flowing, and anybody's ever been on a river finds that after the rapids, it slows down again. Right? And it's all the same river. But the reason I say that last rather than first is one has to have a deep practice to be able to do that. So, you know, before we do class 4 rapids, we should make sure that we have the capacity, right? Or at least, you know, if we haven't spent a lot of time in the river, we may want to start with class 1 rapids, class 2 rapids, see how we do before we hit the class 6. But that's why in the same way, you know, one can certainly meet the challenges of a busy, pressured life, I think with a lot of freedom and ease. One has to be able to really just go through all those activities without attaching and grasping at anything. You just deal with whatever deals as it arises, and as soon as it's done, you move on to the next thing. Right? No drama. The drama is what we create in our head. You know, it's the stories that are projected out onto just really what's arising and passing. But, you know, one has to, you have to have the Manjushri sort of wisdom right here. You can't put it down for a minute, you know, because you have to be willing always to be cutting away anything, you know, that tries to grab on, that tries to make something out of it. Because if you think about it, you know, I mean, you might think about your life, and you might think back 6 months or a year or 2 years, and you might remember, you know, something that was so important that you're so completely stressed out, you couldn't sleep, you know what I mean? So, and now you go, I mean, did you even think about it anymore? And you say, no, I haven't thought about that in years. And even when you think about the situation now, it doesn't stress you. Why not? If there was something inherently stressful in the situation, you'd still be stressed out about it. But you're not. We look back and we go, yeah, I mean, it all resolved itself. Right? And we look back in our life and we see, you know, some things I really handled well, some things I didn't handle well. But sometimes I'm still here. Right? The river keeps flowing. Right? Awareness, consciousness, moment to moment arising, just continue. Right? So, you know, my job is just to be here. Well, just like the, you know, the samurai of old, just here. No past, no future, no birth, no death, no success, no failure. Right? I don't care what people think of me. You know what I mean? It's like all that stuff is in absence. And you just show up in awareness, presence, clear, free. As you know, there's a well-known saying in Zen that a small saint hides themselves in the mountains, a great saint hides themselves in the marketplace. It's really a wonderful phrase. You know,
you're a little saint and you want to look saintly, you know, everybody looks like a saint when they're all alone up in the mountains. Nothing to harass you, nothing to disappoint you, you know what I mean? Everybody looks very calm and peaceful and relaxed. So, you know, that's what they say, a small saint, they hide in the mountains. But a great saint, you know, in the marketplace means right in the hustle and bustle of life. Right? If they can manifest in the hustle and bustle of life, equanimity and peace of mind and openness, then you know that person is a great saint. So, and this, you know, historically has been the orientation of Zen and the importance of the practice. It is the practice that one, you know, that it's not situation specific, doesn't have to go on in a certain place, but can be practiced right in the midst of daily activity. You know, those great letters of Hakuin to his, some of his students about that. How to wield the sword of Manjusri in the midst of daily activity. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question about resentment.
Mm-hmm. You mean how to get better at it? No. We don't need any help with that, do we? We do that quite well on our own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is something that's said. So this is, let's say, something, I mean, the resentment is coming from something that happened, let's say, in your childhood where somebody did something to you or somebody you know that was hurtful or painful. So there was a real incident that happened. Okay. That's very important, especially because we know that, today in our society, awareness of the long-term, psychological distress that is caused to people by trauma from childhood. You know, this is something that we didn't understand. The society that, you know, that much, but with the whole, in the last 30, 40 years, child abuse, sexual abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the whole thing, there's much greater awareness of the significance of early childhood traumas and the long-term psychological, emotional effect it has on people. So we're very much aware of that. So something happens to us as children. Somebody has harmed us when we were, we could say, innocent. We were victims of somebody else's acting out, somebody else's ignorance or delusion or greed or whatever. And at a certain stage in our adult development, we realize that that wound is still here in me. And we know that at this point in our lives, it is still operating within us. In terms of how it affects us emotionally and how it affects our behavior, relationships, lots of things, right? So we know the path, our path is one of healing and transformation. Right? We want to become whole. The Buddhist path is a path of liberation from suffering. And even though it is often couched in terms of liberation from ignorance, liberation from delusion, you know, big liberation, big freedom. The Buddha was very clear that it's about all suffering to be liberated from, especially the suffering that's conditioned from the past. So the first step is we acknowledge the suffering. And we look deeply into it. And we see
the causes and conditions that created it within ourselves. I think forgiveness is a good thing at some point. But I think forgiveness it usually happens naturally toward the end of the healing. I mean, it is easy for us to say to someone, because we know it's the right thing to do, I forgive you. But in our emotional body or whatever, we haven't healed yet. So even though forgiving is an acknowledgement that we want to let go, often that place within us is not yet strong enough to really do that. You know, when someone has deeply wounded you, that's really not you. It's really it's the child you were, right? Because in truth, you know, you're not the same. They're not the same. It's really all gone on. But somehow, in the world of story, in the world of self, it still has a reality to it. And the acknowledgement of the suffering. And you're doing everything you can to heal that part of you that is wounded. Right? It's most important. At some point, when you feel that you've healed a lot of that, but the resentment still remains, right? The personal resentment, oftentimes what I find is looking deeply into causes and conditions is most helpful. Right? Because one has to understand at some point, when one's ready, that individual was also a product of causes and conditions. Right? I mean, again, it's like we said earlier, there's no beginning and end of time. Everything you can trace everything back to a cause, right? Every effect can be traced back to a cause. But that cause that you may get to is the effect of prior causes. Right? Which is the effect of, you know what I mean? So once you begin to see all these, you know what I mean, that here's this person who did that to you or to me, right? But you realize there were lots of things that were done to that person that led them to do what they did. And there were lots of people that led from even before, and you begin to see this whole chain of causes and conditions, lots of different people and situations, right? But are just flowing down through time. You know, it's sort of like a behavior, emotional behavioral dysfunctional avalanche. And it just keeps rolling down, right? And all of a sudden, you know, at some point in time and space, Lindsay got in the way, right? And got whacked. And when one does that kind of deep looking, a lot of times that begins to diffuse the personal resentment. Because one realizes that that person was also the victim of causes and conditions. That wounded them. That hurt them. That twisted them. You know, how did they become who they became? And so you begin to, you know, as you kind of trace it back and see it's all the different people in this situation, you realize it's just this endless, you know, in the same way we could say the Dharma is a transmission of truth and beauty and goodness and wholeness, and, you know. But there's lots of other things that are being transmitted down through the human family, right? And you know, there's also lots of transmission of pain, lots of families, you can see it, generation after generation, they just keep transmitting pain. Right? Unhappiness, dysfunctional patterns, alcoholism, you know, all kinds of things. It's just generational, just transmitting down, parent to child, grandparent, you know. So you begin to see how big it all is. And that it's really not even about you. You know, when you get to that point, it's like what you're saying, Andy. You know, you need a deep practice to be in the midst of activity and pressure and to really be able to just move through it easily and skillfully. Right? And you need a certain level of depth to your practice before you can see all that clearly. When you're no longer, you have to have already healed that wounded place within yourself and really taken care of that and made sure it is whole before you can do this bigger kind of work of really forgiving. I mean, again, it's easy to forgive the words. And people do mean it, you know. But especially if it's a deep wound, it's very difficult to be free of that, as you see, because as you say, the resentment still comes up. So again, the deep looking into causes and conditions. You know, it is, you know, it's often said that the real compassion means that, which is not easy, especially for someone, you know, it's easy to be compassionate to innocent. It's very hard to be compassionate to, you know, like it's easy to be compassionate to victims. It's much harder to be compassionate to perpetrators, right? You know, does that make sense? I mean, it's just, you know, our natural sympathy and understanding, we don't want to extend it to those people, right? But in this practice, that's what we call it, equanimity and equality, eventually we want to be able to, because they're victims too, right? But we see them as perpetrators. We don't realize that they were victims. It was their victimization that got them to develop as perpetrators. Right? So that willingness to step out of my own suffering or pain or view and to step into them and to say, how did you get here? What created you? What causes and conditions created you that you would, I want to do harm to a child. We know something must have happened, right, along the way. And that capacity to let go and to enter into that, you know, with a desire to really understand that, is really compassion. And I think you'll find at that point that the resentment will begin to dissipate very quickly because you'll have deep understanding. That they are just the product of forces that were beyond their control. In the same way that you didn't ask to have happened to you what happened to you, right? In the same way you can see, and all of a sudden you begin to see that that's so much of what's going on in this world. People are just, you know, endlessly the recipient of causes from the past. And they reap the effects. And just blindly they just pass it on. I mean, my sense in, you know, like let's say your family tree, that maybe you passed on these things. You may be the first person, I don't know, in that family tree that stopped and looked deeply. So in that way, each of us often has the capacity of healing our whole family tree. Because when one looks back, one sees it was just passed on. People just thought this is just the way it was. You know, generation, the same painful pattern gets passed on. Until finally somebody goes, what's really going on here? This is not normal. This is suffering. This is, right? And you take the time not just to heal yourself, but you look deeply into the causes and conditions that created this. And when you realize, I do no longer have to live in that, nor do I have to pass it on, all of a sudden it stops. that transmission of pain going back generations stops with Lindsay. In that way, you have the capacity of healing, you know, mothers and grandmothers, you know, and all these generations, you know, that were traumatizing this way and didn't know what to do with the pain. So in that sense, you have a sense that you are, you know, you're working for your ancestors. You're doing for them what they couldn't do. Is it? I mean, does that speak to what you were asking? It is the, that's why it's said in, that, you know, while there are many good anger management techniques, in the Bodhisattva tradition, the capacity to really be willing to step into the shoes of the person we are angry at and to see the causes and conditions that have created them and led them to that moment to do what they do will dissipate the anger. It doesn't mean we don't say no or we don't deal with it, but the anger and resentment disappears because we have understanding. And then we can also, when we have understanding, we can also have compassion. We're then able to see their suffering, their pain. And how really, you know, we often say, oh, you know, they, you know, it's like we say, oh, well, they really knew better. Right? Or we say, they should have known better. But if we really stop, we realize they don't. If they knew better, they wouldn't have done it. They obviously don't know better. And it's hard for us to accept that they really don't know better. Right? But they didn't know better. And it's a willingness to just see that, you know, that people live with heavy doses of delusion. I remember years ago when, many years ago, I worked with sexual perpetrators. You know, I mean, a group of human beings that most people have great aversion to, for obvious reasons. And it was quite amazing to me where they would talk about their sexual relations with the children, you know, like 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds, and talking as if the child wanted it, or was kind of asking for it. I mean, it was just so delusional, you know. And they actually had convinced themselves. And it just struck me, you know, the human capacity for self-deception and delusion is really infinite, isn't it? And that's just one example. You know, part of this, I think, practice is to understand when there is fundamental ignorance of the true reality of things. Often the most horrible things can be perpetrated. And we know that because we see that in our world all the time. So to this day, all over the place. How can that be? How can people still kill each other? Rape each other? You know, be so inhuman to each other? Right. One might say, right? But the truth is, if we let go of that, how can that be? And enter into that person, enter into that situation, you know, we understand it. Right? Like Thich Nhat Hanh's famous poem, Call Me By My True Name, I think many of you know that. It's probably his most famous. Where he says, you know, I am the mayfly, and I am that. That's eating the mayfly, and I am, you know, it's all. Remember, he says, I am the 8-year-old boat person who's been on the China Sea, you know, escaping from Vietnam, who was raped by the pirate. And I am that pirate who grew up you know, in poverty on the islands of Thailand, where that's where being a pirate was all my family did. I am both the 8-year-old girl, but I'm also the pirate. I am both the mayfly, and I am both the frog that eats the mayfly. Yeah. To have that, to be able to see that is to be willing to look deeply. The frog is doing what it's done because causes and conditions that create frogs and they fly. Again, it doesn't mean if you have the opportunity to protect an 8-year-old from a pirate, you don't do that. It doesn't mean you don't act. It just doesn't mean you don't hate. You don't resent because you understand that they didn't Christ say something like that? I'm not an expert on that. They know not what to forgive them. They don't know what they do. Something like that. Sort of like that. Any other questions about practice before we end tonight? So we will continue with the teaching we started yesterday, the day of mindfulness, the 8 realizations of great beings. And when we continue. Thank you. Thank you all. Any announcements?
Next week, next Sunday, we'll have a guest teacher.